session number 27342, reel 1.
Jack Thomas, reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born on June the 18th, 1924, in Durham, in a little village called Sacriston, about 3 miles outside the city of Durham. Mm-hmm.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked at the local coal mine. He was what was known as a master's weighman. He was in charge of weighing the coal as it came out of the pit.
Mm-hmm. And did you grow up there?
Yes. It's rather strange, actually, because at the age of three, we emigrated to Australia. At the age of seven, we came back again to the same village. My father was told there were rosy opportunities in Australia by a friend who'd gone out there before him, and they sold up the house and everything, and with me as a child of three, we set off for Australia. We sailed out there. It was, I think, about 6 weeks voyage. And when we got to Perth, there was a letter waiting for my father saying, oh, by the way, don't come out, there's a slump. So we were there, as I say, about 3.5-4 years, and my father was in and out of work all the time. It was a strange time. Had all sorts of jobs, everything from being a sort of equivalent to like an AA man, riding a motorbike around, to a manager of a car factory, to a travelling salesman. Whatever job was good, he took it. But my mother couldn't stand the heat, really. The weather was too hot, and we came back again. And we went back to the same village I started from, which is rather a problem for me because I came back with a fruity Australian accent into a Geordie primary school. And so there's no good when I was told of the talk and say, "Now, miss, it wasn't me." Among all the Geordies, yes.
Do you have any memories of that time while you were in Australia?
Yes, I do. Yes, odd little bits and pieces. I can remember going to school in the morning, and we used to take a bunch of grapes from the garden to have with my lunch, and to sit on the steps outside the little school. And I can remember going, I was supposed to be going up into the junior school from the infant school, and looking forward to that. And when I was told we're going back to England, I didn't want to go. So they told me about this interesting stuff called snow, which was white and cold, and you could do things with it, you could slide on it. I thought, well, perhaps I might go back and see this snow business then. So I came back that way, yes.
What about your education in Australia and then when you came back?
Well, in Australia, just the usual, whatever was normal at the time there. I can remember the strange thing about looking back at it now was that it was sort of patriotic. Every morning we started, and it looked like the American system where you start with your hands on your heart, and you used to say, "God save the king, hats off we stand." That's what I remember about the school there, really. Came back to England to the local junior school, and in those days the great thing was to get your scholarship, as they called it, to get to the grammar school, because if you didn't get the grammar school, you were working down the pit, and I certainly didn't want to work down the pit, and my parents didn't want me to either. Anyway, I passed the grammar school, went to the Johnson School in Durham, and for quite a while, until I was 17. I was always interested in art as a subject, and really on the art side, but in my school certificate exam that they had in those days, I did actually better in the sciences than the arts, and the headmaster decided that I should go into the sixth form and do for the high school certificate, which was two main subjects in the subsidiary. I should do maths, physics and chemistry as a subsidiary. I said, "But sir, I want to do English, history and art as a subsidiary." "Rubbish, boy, nonsense," he said. "You'll do sciences and like it." So I did a year in the sixth form, which I didn't like at all, and left. And then as soon as I was old enough, I went for a temporary job in a bank, which I found very boring. As soon as I was 17 and a quarter, I volunteered to go into the Fleet Air Arm.
As a boy, did you have any kind of hobbies or sports that you participated in?
Well, yes, I was very keen on model aircraft. Used to make model aircraft. In those days, you didn't have kits. You got pieces of balsa wood, other wood. You carved the kits out and painted them and made them up yourself. You see, carved the planes out. Yes, and I used to fly the propeller-driven, elastic-driven models. Warnefords, I think, was the name of the things there, yes. But I was always interested in the fleet. It was strange, really, because when I was about 9 or 10, I used to read a magazine called The Boy's Own Paper, which was, I don't think it exists at all now. And there were very good authors wrote in there, the usual sort of children's authors and adventure book authors, like W.E. Johns and people. And I read a series of stories about a chap who was a pilot on an aircraft carrier. And I thought, when I grow up, I'm going to be part of the aircraft carrier. And there's another series of stories about the merchant navy, and there's the hero as the second mate in this merchant ship. And I thought, when I grow up, I'd like to be an officer in the merchant navy. And funnily enough, it came out in the end, I achieved both ambitions by the age of 19 and a half. So I've never been ambitious since.
Did you kind of get any magazines related to aviation as well by that time?
No, because I didn't really know about them in that sense. There wasn't a sort of range of magazines in those. It's mainly the Boy's Own Paper was my entree into that sort of thing. They did articles, because they had articles on how to make things, how things worked and so on. It was a very, very good magazine, actually, so that was my main interest there. I read all the W.E. Johns, but the Biggles books, of course. Biggles was a great hero, yes.
Did you get a chance to have a flight at all while you were younger?
No, I used to go occasionally to see some air shows, a place called Usworth in Durham. There was an aerodrome there, and I remember seeing Alan Cobham's flying circus there. My father took me to see there, which I thought was fascinating. But the flights were rather expensive. I think something like half a crown. We couldn't really afford that, so I'm afraid I didn't get a flight at all there. I did I was in the ATC when I was still at school, and at the various camps there I had a flight. The first flight I had was in a Lysander, actually, which was very interesting. I didn't realise till I read about it a few years ago that the Lysander was an extremely dangerous aeroplane to fly in and killed an awful lot of pilots. But it seemed a very nice aeroplane at the time. And that was my first experience of flying, when I really felt this is what I want to do. This fantastic business of getting into the air and seeing the world drop away beneath you, and this idea that you're in a different place altogether. I thought, this is it, you know, this is what I really want to do. So that was my first real flight, yes. Why, I don't know why I went to the Fleet Air. It was partly because of what I'd read about in the past, and also it was also a little bit awkward, I think, because most of my friends went to the RAF, but I decided the Fleet Air Arm, it was for me.
So, when you left school, what year did you leave school?
In 1941.
Mm-hmm. So obviously
the
war had broken out.
Oh yes, and we had all the news on about the war, and everything was going out. Was our background? Yes, yes.
Had you heard Neville Chamberlain's speech on that Sunday morning at all? Any memories of that?
Yes, I did. I remember hearing it, and it was a curious sort of blank feeling, because you didn't really grasp what was going on, in the way that later on you didn't grasp at that age the danger that we were in. It never crossed my mind, and in fact I never met anybody whose minds had crossed that we might lose the war. You get a lot of people today talking about the idea about how they've thought we're in a dangerous situation, we're going to might lose and so on. I never really met anybody who did at that time, strange though it may seem.
Had you thought we were going to war prior to that period?
Yes, we're pretty certain about it. I mean, I can remember at school we used to play war games. Time of the Spanish Civil War, we used to play, what do you call it, Republicans and Nationalists, and fight each other in the playground. You know, you were brought, that was in the air all the time there, you see, so you knew it was coming. But as kids, it's an adventure more than anything else. My father had been in the First World War, and his career was very interesting, because he was one of the only two private soldiers who escaped from a prison camp in Germany. I don't know whether you want to know about this.
Yes,
but,
yeah,
but which is very unusual. He was in prisoner of war for a year. He was in the Durham Light Infantry, incidentally. He joined the 8th Durham, which was a territorial battalion, although he wasn't in the territories himself, but a cousin of his was a captain in the battalion and got him in as a Lance Corporal without any training. He went out in the trenches, in the trenches only a week, and he was captured. Spent a year in a prison camp, had a really rough time there, but he made friends with a couple of Frenchmen. He had a natural ability for languages, and he picked up very fluent French, which is interesting. Anyway, he and a couple of Frenchmen, after, it's a long story, but in the end they escaped and got away to Holland, and then they were repatriated, and for I think it was 6 weeks he was locked up in Britain in a sort of prison camp, because they couldn't believe that an ordinary soldier could escape. Officers could, because they didn't work during the day, where the ordinary soldiers had to work down the coal mines or in the fields in the day. But as I say, in the end, he proved who he was, and they accepted his knowledge of French. He sent him back as a in the intelligence corps to Dieppe, where he acted as an undercover agent. And he lived for a year in France, living in a French pension, without his landlady knowing he was English. Worked at the docks as a docker, and he was involved in the arrest of two German spies, and he got a meritorious service medal for that. The interesting thing about this was, I always felt that if ever I got captured, I'd have to escape too, like my dad did. Anyway, that's my background there.
Well, given your father's experience in the First World War, how did your parents feel really about the coming of the Second World War and your potential involvement in it?
Well, I was a bit insensitive to this at the time. It's only really later on I realised what they must have felt. Once I had a family of my own, you realise this. You don't think about it as the person yourself, how your parents feel. You've got to become a parent to feel how a parent feels. So that's what I'd say about that, really, yes. And obviously they were worried about me, and but I didn't grasp the amount of that at all. It must have been very, very hard for them, really.
And with the war coming, what was your first memories, kind of the restrictions that were brought in?
Oh, well, too, mainly the sort of the food rationing. I always had a good appetite. The other thing was that the school was closed for a term. Before I did my school certificate, they closed the school down because there'd been some bombing in Newcastle early on in the war and before the main blitz, and they really thought the northeast was going to get hammered, you see, in the industrial area. In fact, it wasn't really bad. Newcastle had a bit of bombing, but they closed the school for a term, and I remember that's the happiest term of my time at school because I always liked working on my own. We used to go into school once a week and get the work we had to study. I used to go home and do it, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. I've always liked being on my own like that, and so I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you have a shelter at home at all?
Yes, we had not the Anderson shelter, the one that was a table shelter.
Is that the Morrison
shelter? Morrison, yes. It was a big, heavy metal table which sat in the sitting room, and we used to play table tennis on it most of the time, yes. But that's where we went underneath when there was an air raid warning, yes.
And what about the blackout where you lived, was there?
Oh, yes, we're very particular about the blackout. We're very, very careful about that. Being a mining village, I think they thought it might possibly be a target area anyway, so they're very particular there, yes. Yes, but as I say, as soon as I got myself into the forces, yes. I was 17 and a half when I volunteered, but I had to be over 18 to go in, so in fact I was 18 and a half when I actually went in November 1942.
How did you go about volunteering?
Right, well, I went to the... I made inquiries through the ATC. I was in the Air Training Corps, and I heard about this Y scheme, as it was called, where you applied to the Navy to join as a prospective air crew in the Fleet Air Arm. And I was interviewed at a place in Darlington. I remember going in my ATC uniform there, and had medical and so on, and I was questioned by a bunch of senior-looking naval officers who sat behind a table. Very awe-inspiring this was, yes. I remember them pumping questions at me, you see, the sort of various things about my background, my interests and so on. I remember I was very interested in model aircraft, as I said, and I was quite good on aircraft recognition. And one of the chaps pushed a little plane model to me, and he said, "What's this aeroplane here?" I said, it's a Walrus, actually, but the engine's on the wrong way around. We've got it back to front." Good lad, he said. Thought, you know, they'd got a Walrus, so they'd taken the engine and put it the other way around. He said, it was a pusher, the Walrus. And I remember that, whether that got me or not, I don't know. But anyway, I was accepted. I got this little flash to wear on my arm, which is RNYE, which I put on my ATC uniform. And then I sort of sat and waited. And then in November the 2nd, 1942, went to Leon Solent.
Can I ask you a little bit about the activities with the ATC as well, mm-hmm. what you were actually doing? Yeah.
Well, we did. It was really sort of basic training, a lot of drill and stuff like that. We used to visit aerodromes occasionally. Like I said, got a flight at this particular occasion. I know I finished up as a corporal in the ATC, which is something, I suppose. But I'd been in the boys' brigade before that, so I'd been a staff sergeant in the boys' brigade. So I was always used to the drill. That didn't bother me, which is one thing. When I went in the Navy, I had no problem with that. It was just, you know, I'd done a lot of it, where some people had a great deal of trouble about the marching and drilling and so on, yeah.
We mentioned drilling and obviously aircraft recognition. Mm. Was there anything else that you did with the ATC?
Yes, we used to do a little bit of playing around with an Aldous lamp, a little basic Morse code, very, very basic, just really learning it and seeing how it worked. That was the main thing, and aircraft recognition lectures we used to have and things like that. But that's what I remember of it mainly. Mainly it was sort of camps marching about and drilling with rifles and things like that.
With the aircraft recognition, did you use models or was it posters and
models, slides? Models and models and occasional posters. When we got into the Navy itself, they had much more sophisticated ways of doing it, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you'd had your selection interview,
yeah,
and you were waiting then.
Waiting, bored to tears in the bank, working in the bank, a small village bank, a mining village in Durham, with a bank manager, a cashier, and myself. The manager used to interview influential customers in his office. The cashier worked at the counter, and I did everything else, it seemed like, at the time, for 15 shillings a week. It was very good.
A small point, but during the war, was it an effect on banking at all, or did it carry on much as prior to the war?
Just the same, I think. I mean, I don't know much what it was like before the war at all, but the main difference, well, this is rather probably fairly amusing, I think. It amused me anyway. When I went to work in the bank, I had to be interviewed, and I had to go along with my father, you see, and the idea was to see whether I was a suitable sort of person to work in the bank. My father was going along with the idea to see whether the bank was suitable for people to employ his eldest son. And there was rather a conflict between my father, who was a very determined person, and he had a bit of an argument with the bank manager. Anyway, the manager said, really accepted, he said, now you'll be required to wear a dark suit. He said, we're a bit slack these days, you won't necessarily have to wear a morning suit for the blackjack and pinstripe trousers, but a dark suit will do, you see. So that was fine, so I got my dark suit, went to work in the bank, and at the end of the first week I went in on the Saturday morning, and I was summoned to the manager in his office, and he was wearing a sort of orange Harris tweed sports jacket and grey flannels. And he said, Mr Thomas, on Saturdays we dress for the country. This is about a three-man branch in Durham, in a mining village, with miners squatting on the pavement outside the office. I thought it was killingly amusing, that is.
And obviously within the village, had he, economically, had things picked up a little bit with the start of the war?
Yes. In fact, although early on in the 20s and early 30s, the miners had it bad, by the time the war was coming along, they were doing quite well. Their pay were quite good. And the standard of living wasn't bad in most cases, yes. It certainly improved. And my father was a colliery official, and we lived. It was very much a class-divided society. You see, I mean, there was the even as far as the church was concerned, we went to the St John's Methodist Church, which was known as the Boss's Chapel, and it was the primitive Methodist church where the workers went to. And I mean, I look at it now; it was incredible, really. Yes, and my mother's family were rather in the squirearchy, really. They had a pedigree that went back to 1541, and I was brought up with a lot of aunts who had ideas above their station, which I found quite amusing, really. So,
So can you take me through what happened when you received your call-up?
Right, well, I was given a warrant, which was something unusual, and I went on a train, which I hadn't been on since... We came back from Australia when I was seven. I hadn't been on a train then. Although there was a railway station a few miles from the village, it was always bus transport around the district. So that was quite an adventure in itself, going off. And I remember going off and feeling very, very lonely because it was something totally different. I'd never been away to school. This was the big difference I found when I went in, that I made friends with people who'd been in public schools. And they weren't a bit bothered by it at all. In fact, the life of the Navy was luxury compared to some of the sisters they'd been under in the public schools. But we turned up at Leon Solent, train down to London, then to Portsmouth, across the ferry to Gosport, and then we were collected in lorries and taken to Leon Solent. And then the different life began.
How were you received at Leon Solent?
Very pleasantly, really. They were a very friendly lot. I mean, they shouted at us a bit. But the thing is that I always, having been involved in drilling for the Boys Brigade, the ATC, I realised that when NCOs shout at other people, it's part of a game. It's your play. And it didn't bother me. Some people were quite hurt by the fact that they were cursed out and blinded out by senior naval petty officers. But I realised that they weren't as bad as they looked, really. It was all part of the thing, you know. And the first month in the Navy was rather peculiar because I thought I'd joined the Army by mistake. We spent most of our time dressed in number 13, which is navy blue boiler suits, with rifles and bayonets, crawling around doing assault courses and things like that. We did basic sort of military training. And marching and drilling and so on, but bayonet drill, rifle drill, operating the Lewis gun and so on. And it was, as I said, I felt I got in the wrong service.
Mm. Well, can we take you through some of those bits of training that you did in that first month?
Yes.
Rifle training, how did you do that?
What do you mean exactly?
How did they instruct you in it? Where did you go?
Oh, we went through all the usual rifle drill of, you know, order arms and present arms and everything else, which, as I say, I knew something about, so it wasn't too much of a handicap for me. There was one little difference. Two things. One, as far as I remember, we stepped off on a different foot in the Navy from the RAF and the ATC. But the other thing was that, where in all the other forces, to bring people to attention, it was a sort of attention. In the Navy, it was just chow. That's just the one syllable. And that, remember, that struck me as something rather different. One interesting thing there, I remember seeing a squad of Marines drilling on the parade ground there, thinking, man, well, they're smart, that lot. And the sergeant was shouting at them. He said, "You scruffy lot, you look like the Grenadier Guards." And I thought, well, that puts the Marines in the position where they think they are, you see. Yeah.
So, when you'd arrived, what was the first things they kind of issued you with?
Oh, uniform first. That was the first thing. You got your kit, all this amazing uniform, bits and pieces which I'd never seen before. You were given a wooden stamp with your letters of your name on and an ink pad to stamp everything with your name on. You were given a series of injections of various sorts. You were taught how to put this uniform on. And the naval uniform is not very good for people who have had a series of injections, because with swollen arms and an aching back, to get into this one-piece suit. Nowadays, I believe there's a zip fastener somewhere, but in those days, you climbed into it. And you had the various pieces of kit. You were taught how to fold your uniform, how to... to me, a shock that I had to iron my own clothes. My mother always looked after me till then. To iron your trousers, so they folded up the seven creases for the seven main battles of Nelson, wrapped in a lanyard round it, and that put the place of your pillow, because you didn't have pillows in the Navy, you didn't have sheets, you had blankets, and you lay on your trousers, you see, folded up. Your collar had to be ironed in a particular way. But the great thing was, as soon as possible, to get rid of what was called the pusser effect, the purser effect of the formal naval uniform. And I think, unlike most of the forces, the Navy always had this little aside where it was somewhat different. You went out with your uniform, and you went to a tailor and had it modified. And where the proper naval uniform was a V opening like that, you had it cut in a sort of curve. You had your collars bleached so that it looked as if you'd been in the Navy for some time, to a paler blue than a new-looking one. And your trousers were made into what are called a tiddly trousers. They took a gusset in the side and flared them out more than the official flare. So that was the thing, you see. You didn't want to go ashore looking like a rookie, so you had this. Our particular difference as well was, because we were technically officer cadets, we had white cap bands which we wore on our... caps. A lot of people, when they went ashore, didn't like the people think that, so they won't put HMS bands on instead. They thought a bit more anonymous that way and get ribbed by some of the more horny-handed matlows round about. Yes.
I was going to say, would that have singled you out, really?
It would have done, yes, in that case, yes. But
what about accommodation?
Accommodation, we were in huts. Not too bad at all. Washing was a bit primitive. They had sort of, I remember, had like sort of troughs with taps on, and you washed above this trough. The toilets were available, but to me, anyway, I brought up in a rather gentle way, rather embarrassing, because they had no doors on the toilets, and people queued up and said, "Come on, hurry up." And I say, the public school boys didn't mind a bit about that. They were quite used to this. But that was one of the first sort of shocks. The food wasn't too bad at Leon Solent. When we got the next place, it was horrible. This was the first month. To say it was fairly basic and went over fairly quickly.
What would you get food wise? What were the types of meals they were providing?
Well, you had your breakfast would be just sort of porridge or something like that, perhaps cornflakes, chunk of bread, which we didn't have toast to start with at all. Lunchtime, we usually had sandwiches, and your main meal was sort of more or less early evening time, and it would be basically meat of some indescribable sort with a few vegetables, stews, that sort of thing. Not too bad. I don't remember that very much there, because we seemed to get sandwiches occasionally, cheese sandwiches. I can remember quite a lot of cheese sandwiches. The food at as when I came to St Vincent later on was so awful, it put all that out of my mind. I mean, I sort of, that was looked back as sort of quite normal conditions there, yes.
So you said that a lot of part of your day would be taken up by drill.
Drills, and yeah.
Now, you said you took to it quite well because of your previous experience. Did everybody take to drill that quickly?
No, because we had rather amusing. We had one chap in our course who rejoiced in the name of Castañas Flores. Now, he was half Mexican. I don't quite know how he got into the fleet air arm. He was an interesting chap. He was about 6 foot 6 tall, as thin as a lath. Public school boy, very, very far back as far as we were concerned, and had no idea, no coordination whatsoever. And he just couldn't fit in with anything at all. I remember we did one part of the drill was lay down arms, where you lay down arms and you put your rifle on the ground. You had various things to go through, you see. He had this command about lay down arms, you see, then take up arms, that sort of thing. Well, Flores went in, he said, OK, chaps, put your guns on the ground. And the petty officer rose 3 feet in the air and said, guns, guns, guns is 16-inch rifles on battleships, which chucks big bricks at other battleships. He says, these bundukes are rifles, rifles, he said. And that's what... his second instance of Flores was... I'm really interested in these societies. He, when doing the drill, was marching the squad, and he couldn't stop them. So he marched us right through a flower bed and out the other side. And he was howled out by the petty officer, who halted them and said, bring back onto the parade ground. So he did, right back through the flower bed again. Another thing with it, we had one example of throwing a hand grenade. This was going to be a great treat. This, we stood in a trench, and we pulled the pin out of the hand grenade. You let it go, counted three, threw it, and ducked. Flores did all that, except he dropped it in the trench. And he and the petty officer scrabbled about a bit, and then the petty officer managed to grab it, get it over the trench and out before it went off, luckily. But that was him. The third thing was his bayonet drill. The chief who took us with him, a young chief petty officer, and he had a sawn-off billiard cue, which he used. He used to use this for prodding people, and he also used it with his bayonet drill. He would parry your drill. Whatever you did, he could parry it. He was brilliant. And you had to sort of try to attack him and so on, went through the various activities. Flores, who was totally uncoordinated, actually stabbed downwards like this, and he put his bayonet through the side of the boot of the chief petty officer and pinned it to the floor without hurting him, actually. The language was in... I'd heard words I'd never heard of in my life before. It was most entertaining. Needless to say, he didn't survive. He went as far as the next stage, and then he vanished somewhere into the woodwork. He just didn't... He was an incredible cat. I often wonder what happened to him, actually. Yes.
Was it then the technique of the instructors then to allow a recruit to take a bunch of recruits?
Oh, yes, you did this all the time. This was part of the thing, because you were on a course which was where you were going to finish up, or if your nose was clean, to finish up as an officer, and you had to learn to deal with things. You were watched at all the time for what they called OLQ, officer-like qualities. We never really found out what they were, whether it meant did you pick your nose in public, or did you eat with peas with a knife, or whatever it was, I don't know. But part of it was obviously that we were encouraged to take it in turn, to be sort of acting leading airmen and to drill the squad, you see, all the time. That was fun. Or to take charge of marching people to a particular lecture, that sort of thing. Just a bit of training, that kind of, yeah.
And what about the huts that you were in? Was that organised with some money?
Yes, I don't remember much about Vincent, really, except it was about Daedalus. It was all right, not bad at all. Apart, I said the washing facilities weren't too good. It was November and it was cold. You had to go outside to the ablutions in this sort of like an open kind of hut, and that was a bit chilly. I remember that. We had coke stoves in the huts, which were kept you reasonably warm. We were in double decker bunks. In fact, I remember being on a bunk underneath a chap I met on that first day, a chap called Les Shaddock, and he and I became very close friends, and we stuck together quite a long time. Another person who lived with a bed close to me was Charles Goff, who's a friend of mine now, and I still see him every month at our Fleet Air Arm meetings here. So that was a long acquaintance, a long life.
Was there somebody in charge of the hut, though?
Yes, well, there was a leading hand, Lady Seaman, in charge of the hut, just a general charge. It didn't bother us very much. We had to get up in the morning at the right time when the bugle went over the loudspeaker. You were dragged unwillingly from your beds the dark early morning and off to things. But you did do a lot of doubling about. That was the thing. You didn't walk in march. You doubled most of the time. I didn't like that because I had rather protruding ankle bones. I'd never worn boots in my life before, and the boots used to make my ankles very sore for quite a long time before they hardened to it.